you're not starting from a place that people expect. So there's like a little charge that you get, like in the same way that you can get a charge from like telling an audience, like, this thing you love, I think it sucks. You can get the same charge, right, from being like, this thing that you think sucks, I think is cool.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Culturally Relevant, a podcast featuring conversations about film, television, art, and culture. I'm David Chen, and apologies, today's episode's coming out a day later than it usually does. I usually try to release these episodes on Tuesdays of every week, but I've actually been on vacation for the last week, and I wanted to get this one banked before I left, but didn't have a chance to with all the stuff I had to get done. So as a result, it's coming out a day later. But that being said, I am so excited about today's chat that I had. It's with Josh Gondelman. Josh Gondelman is a comedian and writer who has won 2 Peabody Awards, multiple Emmys, multiple WGA Awards for his work on Last Week Tonight with John Oliver on HBO. He's also a writer and producer for Desus and Miro. His new book, Nice Try, Stories of Best Intentions and Mixed Results, is available now wherever books are sold. Nice Try is a really fun book, and I think it does a great job of capturing Josh's sensibility, which is a combination of bemusement, curiosity, and most importantly, kindness. I first learned of Josh's work through the Modern Seinfeld Twitter account, which is very amusing, and it imagines what plot lines Seinfeld might have in the modern day. But Josh also does one of my favorite things on the internet, which is he does these things called Twitter pep talks, where he offers to give people pep talks if they're feeling down from his Twitter account, which you can follow at twitter.com/Josh Gondelman. He seems like genuinely one of the nicest people on the internet, and I had so much fun talking with him about how he got his start in the entertainment industry, how he approaches his comedy, and how he tries to be the best person he can be in a world that might sometimes tell him that's not the optimal path. So be sure to check out Josh's book, Nice Try, Stories of Best Intentions and Mixed Results. And if you're interested in more episodes of this podcast, you can go to culturallyrelevantshow.com. That's culturallyrelevantshow.com. And you can also follow the show on Twitter at CrevShow. That's CrevShow. CrevShow. And email us at culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com. Thanks so much to everyone who has left Apple Podcast reviews and also tweeted or Facebooked about the show. It means so much to a show like this one. And if you're enjoying the show, I would so greatly appreciate it if you tweet or Facebook about an episode that you appreciate, or leave a star rating for us or review on Apple Podcasts. It means so much to a show like this one. So thanks to all those who have done that, and appreciate it if you would do it in the future. Without further ado, here's my chat with Josh Gondelman. Josh Gondelman, thanks so much for joining me today. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great, thanks. I'm like over a summer cold, basically. I'm like 90% out of the woods, and it really lingered. So happy to talk to you and just feeling great about life.
I had a brutal cold this summer that lasted 3 weeks.
Mine too.
It was the most miserable. What's worse is when you don't know if you're ever going to get better. You have this feeling like, am I going to get over this? You know, like,
yeah.
You've been sick so long. You're like, I don't know if this is going to be one of those permanent things or not. But
right. I'm in my 30s. It could just be the new normal.
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
I just sneeze 100 times a day forever. Or like it was, I had like 10 days. I'm sure this is riveting for your listeners, but our listeners today, it was like a week, 2 weeks, maybe 10 days of being super congested. And that was like starting to clear up. And then I had to travel to Los Angeles for some work stuff. And I didn't act any differently than I would have at home. So I was like out till midnight, which is not terrible, but because it was 3 a.m., my body thought it was 3 a.m. My body revolted. And so it was like 10 days of congestion. And just as that started to abate, my body was like, oh, you idiot. And it was another 10 days of like sore throat, which was substantially worse.
You got to take care of yourself, I think. That's the thing is like, when you're in your 20s, right, you kind of like hit it hard, as it were. You kind of put your body through a lot of things because you just assume it can absorb it.
Yes.
And you get used to that. And then when you get in your 30s, it's like, oh, hey, it can't actually continuously absorb this all the time. But you're already used to putting it through its paces from the 20s.
Right, so right. Like, you know what works for you.
Right.
And then your body switches the beat up and you're like, oh, I have to fully recalibrate this.
Yeah. It can be difficult to adjust. And things like that are very much a part of the fabric of your book, nice try, stories of best intentions and mixed results. And we'll get to that in a bit. But first, I think it's always fascinating to talk about breaking in stories.
Absolutely.
So tell us about how you broke into the entertainment industry.
Sure. Oh my gosh. Thank you for considering me part of the entertainment industry. I started doing comedy, which is very different than entertainment in Boston, where like you are entertaining people, but it doesn't feel like there's an industry behind it. I started stand up. I was doing improv in college. I started doing stand up, then I started doing sketch, and I did that throughout my last 3 years of college, basically, and then stayed in Boston, taught preschool for a few years after college. So I was doing stand up for quite some time locally, and I started doing like festivals out around the country. And then in 2011, I moved to New York, I kind of figured I'd hit a ceiling in New England, and like I was doing kind of as much as I was capable of doing there. Not that I'd done everything, but like certain things were beyond what I was capable of. And then certain things, just like certain opportunities, didn't exist in the capacity that I had hoped to find them, like later as I moved forward. So I moved to New York with the idea of kind of, I'll see if I can take my stand up to the next level, but I really want to see if I can get a writing job of some kind. And that's what didn't exist in New England. There are people there that are incredible comedians and make a living doing stand-up comedy. But like the idea of writing for TV was something that I had to move to try to accomplish. So,
well, tell us a little bit first about like stand-up comedy. You know, you cut your teeth doing stand-up comedy. Like what was behind the idea to hone that skill of yours?
So there's a couple things. I really enjoy doing it. Part of what I like, and I've worked in late night comedy mostly since I've been in TV. And part of what I like about that in stand-up is like you write something, it happens, and then you move on to the next thing. Or you write something, it happens, it's great, you want to like continue working with it in different iterations. So I like the idea of kind of making a thing that you get feedback on right away and not agonizing over something for months or years and hoping that you got it right. That is like, I really admire people who have that skill of like, I'm going to write a novel and it's going to take me 3 years and I will show it to no one for 3 years. And at the end of that, that's when I start going like, hey, is this thing that I dedicated hundreds of hours to, is this any good? that like is truly so daunting to me.
But I guess like what made you go from, hey, people I'm around find me funny or my friends think I'm enjoyable, to like, I want to get up on a stage in front of a light and a microphone and try to do this, you know, potentially professionally?
So I was always a performer throughout like high school. I was in the drama club plays and I really liked that. And I enjoyed performing and I enjoyed writing. I think I was like probably better at writing, especially, you know, I'm not a great actor, but I was like, if I can write things for myself that are fun to say, that's kind of an ideal creative outlet because I get to write it and then I get to deliver the things that I think are funny. So I had a friend named Joe who was already kind of out in the open mic circuit around Boston, and mutual friends of ours were like, well, Joe's doing it, why aren't you doing it? So I kind of got bullied into my career.
Always a great way to get into the career is to get
very fortunate to have it. I mean, like I think probably some people do get bullied into a career, but at least this isn't like my father being like, your father was a whatever, or my father was this, I'm this, and you're gonna be this, you know, a fishmonger or whatever.
Yeah, you're gonna be a late night writer.
I got bullied into doing the thing that I always wanted to do rather than the thing other people wanted me to do.
So once you moved to New York, what happened then?
So I stopped teaching full time and I was tutoring and started doing a little freelance writing, pitching funny pieces to like magazines and websites. And I kept doing stand up, and it was kind of a slow climb to get acclimated to the stand up scene in New York, find outlets that would publish my writing. My tutoring was like scaling back little by little, and I was doing more and more like comedy and writing stuff. And it felt really exciting to feel like, oh, the pie chart of what makes up the way I spend my time and the way I bring in income, which was not a lot of income, but the pie chart was getting more and more filled with the stuff I liked doing the best. So that was really cool. And then the thing that kind of took me from the level of like, this guy maybe has something going on, to like, oh, this is a person that is in the running for jobs, was my friend Jack Moore and I co-founded this Modern Seinfeld parody Twitter account, which sounds so dated and so silly, but it was truly like the first thing that I did that people were like, oh, you're the guy that did that. I like that. Maybe I'll like you, which is like, it takes a long time in stand-up, right? Even when you get pretty good at it and you can make audiences laugh, there's still, you still kind of feel interchangeable with other comedians in a way. Like, there are lots of really wonderful, talented comedians working. So it was like a true leg up in my career to have done a thing that people were like, oh, I've seen that. Cool. You did that. And that's kind of what got me in the running for like comedy jobs. So I spent a year basically applying for late night jobs, which each show that I applied for would have its own specific packet of submission materials required that was unique to the show. And this is 2013, we're talking. Mm-hmm. So midway through 2013, I booked a tiny amount of like consulting joke writing work for Billy on the Street, which was really cool and was kind of the thing that in the middle of this year of just like striving, like, okay, you have these opportunities. Let's see if you can make something of them. In the middle of the year, I had this like bright glimmer of like, oh, maybe I'm not just the guy who had this funny Seinfeld tweet idea. Maybe I'm a guy that could actually get a job. This is very exciting. So I did that. And then
I have to ask you about this, the Modern Seinfeld account.
Please. So
this is at Seinfeld Today.
Yes.
It was launched in December of 2012. And
yes.
As of right now has almost 800,000 Twitter followers, right?
And yeah.
So what was behind the idea of at Seinfeld Today?
So the way it started was I had talked to my friend Dan Balder, who's a super funny comedian based in Boston. And he had said something like, you know, if they had cell phones, you would lose half the plots of Seinfeld. Like, you would just, half of them would be knocked out. And that is like, there is an extent to which that is true, right? Like, there are so many plots that would be so different. There's nothing about like, I'm at this movie theater. What movie theater are you at?
Right.
Or sneaking into someone's house to record, to like change their answering machine tape or whatever. Like, that just doesn't happen in the present day. But like, it's not that Seinfeld had to be rooted in that era of technology. I think like cell phones are the ideal Seinfeld medium because there are so many social customs that are so ingrained, and like people violating those little social agreements is so much of what Seinfeld was about, right? Like people doing things that are just like slightly socially aberrant that drives Jerry crazy, or like George deciding to like game the norms of society for his own twisted benefit. So I was just thinking about that. And I think I was like in a tutoring appointment and I just tweeted something of that nature, something like about one of these plot lines. And I did a couple over the course of the day and people seemed to respond. And my friend Jack saw them and was like, dude, this is like a thing. This isn't just like three tweets. Like people like this, and this is like a whole, there's more depth here. Mm. And so he jumped on the Twitter handle and then we just started co-writing it. And it was really, it was a really fun, exciting experience. And it's like, as silly as it seems to credit a like parody Twitter account that's been dormant for almost 4 years with like bigger picture success, it was really like, for both of us, I think, I don't mean to put words in Jack's mouth, but I think for both of us, it was a really exciting breakthrough when we were both kind of producing work. He was working, I believe, as a sports writer at BuzzFeed, and we were both kind of producing work, but like not quite in the zone that we were striving for eventually. And it was like a real step for both of us to get us there. And Jack's been like writing for sitcoms for years now, and I've been in late night for a long time. And like a lot of it is thanks to that moment kind of pushing both of us to like, oh, this guy's out there working, to like, oh, let's get this person the opportunity to apply for like the jobs that they really want.
Right.
Down the line.
Do you have a favorite one of these modern Seinfeld plot lines?
One of the really early ones that I liked was like, Elaine is hooking up with her upstairs neighbor, and when she breaks it off, he makes his Wi-Fi network name something defamatory about her and won't change it back until she goes out with him again. And that just feels, it just felt very like petty in the wheelhouse of like, where are these pain points in polite society? You know, that like when they're breached, there's no protocol for rectifying it. And that just feels so much to me like where Seinfeld lives.
I think what's fascinating to me reading over the tweets is like how much, as you said, like rooted in technology Seinfeld was, or at least the technological era of the time, right? And like how the limitations of that technology informed a lot of the social awkwardness of that show, right?
Yes.
Because a lot of these, like that specifically is like, you know, for many years of Seinfeld, like Wi-Fi wasn't really a mainstream technology as far as I recall, right? So it is pretty interesting to reflect on like how much comedy is inadvertently shaped by technology.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's like as much as anything of the era, right? It's like what you're steeping in. It's like even when you're not talking about politics, what you're saying and doing is informed by politics and is political. And just like even when you're not talking about texting, the way you talk about dating or staying in touch with your parents is always going to be informed by like what technology is available and possible.
Yeah. Well, congrats on the modern Seinfeld account, you know,
and
it's cool that it has been a way for you to get more work that has in many ways led to the career that you have now. Very awesome.
Thank you. You
are a prolific entertainer, but you also, to me, seem like you're at the beginning of a long and successful career versus at the end of one.
Oh, thank you. I mean, that's the hope.
That said, I'm curious, you know, this book is very much a memoir style book. Tell us about why you decided to write this book, Nice Try, and why now at this point of your career?
Okay, great question. I love writing personal essays, which I think is like narcissism, but I also think it's like my stand-up is largely very personal and there are elements of more narrative storytelling as part of it. So it's always been something I gravitated towards in performance and writing, is like telling stories about my life in a fun way. And I I'd co-written a book with my friend Joe Berkowitz a few years ago, and it was a really cool and satisfying process. But it was also like a lot, like it's a lot of work and it's a long effort. Like I was talking earlier about like the kind of immediate joys of stand-up and the immediate joys of late night writing. And a book is like truly the opposite, in that you spend so much time kind of writing in a dark room or a well-lighted room with no one else around. And you're just like, my head the whole time is screaming like, I don't know, is this anything? So I didn't want to immediately jump right into writing a second book or a first solo book, just because like I had done it and knew what the process was and could have created that opportunity. So I waited a couple of years. The book I wrote with Joe came out in fall 2015, and it took me till like 2017 to start getting the proposal together. And my agent Noah and I went back and forth a lot, kind of thinking about like, here are some stories I want to tell and that I like telling, but what's the big idea that I want to express? And I really wanted to make sure that I had something that was like a tone, a vibe, a theme that felt good to work in for a couple of years. Because I knew from the time I started writing the proposal to the time the book came out and I did the promo cycle, that it would be years, and it would be years that I was kind of sitting with this material. So the idea of Nice Try kind of came out of like, it's so literal, but it works, I think, has a couple of different resonances. One is like trying to be nice, like a try at being nice is something that is really thematic through my life, just attempting to do the right thing and to make the world a kind of like gentler place for the people around me and then people at large. And then also, I mean, to me, it's funny that like nice try, it sounds like such a, it's like almost a compliment, right? It's like something you say when someone has failed. It's the only time you give that compliment. So it's that to me, it's like, so it's almost sarcastic, right? It's almost like, good one, Einstein. But you would never say that when someone actually does something smart. You're never like, wow, you're a real Einstein. You solved, solved human cloning or whatever it is.
Right.
So it's like a compliment that's actually an insult, which I think is very funny.
One of the things I've realized is that, you know, I, as you know, like to create things, and it can be difficult to figure out what format might be best for a given idea or a story. Like, should something be a YouTube video or a podcast or a movie? You're somebody who works in many fields, different media. How did you decide, like, on a book to tell the stories versus, like, another format?
That's a great question. I had written a book before. And so, as I said, I don't mean to keep hearing, like, I don't mean to brag, but I've written a book before.
Look, we get it, Josh, okay? You've written a book, okay?
But so it was something that was comfortable to me. And I think I was at a point, this is 2017, the kind of political tenor of the country was and remains kind of smothering and intense. And so I wanted to make something that I knew I could do and that I had a good sense that I could sell. Like it's like it was pragmatic in a way where I could have written a feature script for a film based on my life or a pilot script based on my life. But like, excuse me, what I wanted was to do something that I knew or had at least a really strong idea could like come to fruition on a timeline that I understood.
Right.
So that was like a big part of it. It was like, I felt like I had the experience doing this kind of project and rather than investing time and energy and like vulnerability, right? Personal vulnerability and professional vulnerability in trying to tackle a new medium and stuff all these ideas into it just on my own time, I thought, you know, I can do this and make it into a project that I'm pretty sure can see the light of day and hopefully people will enjoy it because I've at least like experienced enough to bring it to get it to completion, get it into the world and do it at a like a capable level.
Yeah. I mean, there is like a business pragmatism that comes to mind too, when you're trying to share something with the world, like you want it to be something that will actually be completed, that will actually be distributed. And so like those are factors that must play into whatever you're trying to make.
Totally. And it wasn't, I don't think it was like done cynically as much as it was like, right. It was a practical thought of like, can I do this work that I'm really excited about and share these ideas that I'm really excited about? And what's the way I can reach people with it as opposed to like creating something that will maybe languish on a shelf for a long time.
Right. I mean, movies can take, you know, 8 years to get
made,
or like decades sometimes. Yep. So it's like, a book can, and if you have like a pipeline or people that you know, it can be a good way to get your ideas in the world. One of the things you grapple with in the book is your personality as being a nice guy, you know? And you are one of the nicest people I know on Twitter.
Thank you.
And, you know, I always hear people talk about how, when I'm not seeing how nice you are, I'm hearing people talk about how nice you are. And that seems like it could be a challenge, a challenging persona for a comedian to have. I recently mentioned on this podcast that I think great comedy punches up, not down, but it's generally punching, you know, it's generally punching something. And so it's generally like trying to take a piece out of something, to make fun of something, to be cutting about something. Tell us about the persona you try to create when you're doing your comedy and how that fits in with your actual personality.
Sure. So I start every answer with so, which is like, ugh, but here we go. So that is such a good question because I think there are ways to poke fun at things that isn't like necessarily fully punching. And I think there's like a lot of different ways. And I think we talk about like punching up versus punching down as a way to like talk about systemic power, right? Yeah. Like where what is the target of this joke? And I think there are ways to make fun and create comedy that are like that has like a little more that's a little more inviting, right? Like, I mean, there's still like a common way of doing it. That common, a way that has been really successful that I think people don't always bring up as like a non-punch form of comedy is like kind of the comedy of like, remember when, you know, like, the comedy of like, remember when we were kids and this was the experience? And like, it's a comedy that's like, hey, bringing up kind of just comparing and contrasting the things that are different eras in a way that is like affectionate and like, hey, remember 8-bit Nintendo games? And like when you talk about that, even though you're ostensibly making fun, it's you're really just bringing people on board and contrasting the past versus the present, right? Mm-hmm. So like it's not, I don't think that the tone is like unprecedented. And I also think Gary Gulman, who's like one of the best comedians alive, had said recently in an interview, like, it is so bracing, I think, for audiences when you start a premise with, as opposed to like, don't you hate this?
Yeah.
But in starting with like, I love it when X, Y, Z.
Right.
And I think when I heard him say that, it's kind of also, it's like a similar place to where I write from a lot of the time to find like the unexpected thing you like about a situation. And when I heard him say that, I was like, I knew I was just doing you, but worse. But he, but that is like, he has that long story about Joe's?
Trader Joe's. Yeah. Yes. I was going to say Trader Joe's. Yeah.
Incredible. It's like a canonical comedy bit. Right. Yeah. And so, but it there's the long story about getting in this argument with a woman in line at Trader Joe's. That's the meat of it. But the first several minutes is just him running down what he loves about Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
Or like, I think like a really clarifying moment that I had recently just like watching comedy and being like, oh, that he's unlocked something was John Mulaney talking about his wife saying, I don't mind that you talk about me as long as you're not saying she's a bitch and I don't like her. And his response is, no, she's a bitch and I like her so much. And I feel like that's like what a wonderful inversion of that, of like, you know, I love my cranky wife, as in the internet parlance, right? Instead of the curvy wife guy, he's a cranky wife guy.
Right.
So I think I really like, so on stage, so sorry, this is like a very circuitous answer, but I just like making things that feel warm and inviting for the most part. And I also think that there is a way to be incisive and critical without being aggressive and smothering, right? Like you can get in these little jabs because you have created like a trusting environment for the audience, right? Where you can, I feel like on stage sometimes I can like, or in the book, I can earn myself the right to say something a little more biting because I have created this place of like, look, this, I'm friendly. We're all people here. Let's have a good time. And you get that people feeling safe. And like when you bring up a topic that might be a little more touchy, they don't immediately go like, what now? Like they trust that they're in gentle hands.
Right.
But
I, when I've listened to your comedy, you know, I do feel it's very warm and inviting. And then sometimes you do savage something or some topic, it is, you know, it feels like a little more dangerous than it would be in another context.
Oh, sure. I mean, the danger part of it too is like there is a level of like aggression, I think is what how I would put it, because it's not darkness necessarily.
Yeah.
It's like meanness that audiences will not accept from me.
Yeah.
And it doesn't come up that much, but like when there's like a disturbance in the room, like if there's a heckler, which is again, not very, not again, for the first time, not very common, but like if there is a heckler, I have to tread more gently than some because it like lands really clumsily if I just like, if I'm just like, hey man, shut your fucking mouth. Like, which is a thing that I might feel, but it is like it is a mode of expression that is like jarring for an audience that has heard me talking for 20 minutes already.
Yeah. I was listening to, I think your most recent comedy album, right? What is it called?
Dancing on a Weeknight.
Dancing on a Weeknight. I was listening to it. And at one point, one of the audience members interjects with a punchline, like a suggested punchline to one of your jokes. And you kind of say, like, I don't want to imitate you because I'm not going to do a good job. But you basically put that person in their place and say, like, please leave the punchlines to me for tonight. You know?
Yeah.
And that was like, I was like, oh, wow. Like, I was a little taken aback because you are just in general such a nice human being. But I think what you're saying is you can use that to your advantage.
Sure.
Although if you go too far, then the audience like can turn against you, right?
Yeah. I think there's like a lot of goodwill that I can kind of engender with just friendliness in general on stage. But when someone does something like that, like it's the kind of thing that if it hadn't been a recording, I wouldn't have picked on this woman. She was like slightly out of line to like call out an alternative punchline to a joke.
Uh-huh.
But the only, I think if that was just like an isolated occurrence, like that's what most heckles in a club are. It's just like someone reacting very sincerely to something you've said.
Right.
And generally I can like let that slide. It was good natured. She was having a good time, but because I was recording the album and it was just one show, I kind of wanted to gently demonstrate that that's not helpful and is like contrary to the project at hand, which was me saying the ideas that I came to say. So if it hadn't been for that, I would have just like fully, you know, I might have even, if it was just like a club show, heard what she said and like appreciated it because it wasn't unfunny, but I just had to be like, look, I can't have you giving your director's commentary because like I need this audio essentially.
Right.
So I think what I said was, if you have any other ideas for punchlines, write them down on a piece of paper, then crumple the paper up and throw it in the river.
Yeah. But I totally know what that's like. So I directed a movie called The Primary Instinct, which features Stephen Tobolowsky, the actor, telling stories on stage. And at the beginning of the actual performance that night, I went on stage and gave a little speech to everyone. And I basically like, hey, we're all here to hear Steven's stories, not your stories, you know, like, cause people sometimes like to, you know, chime in and react really loudly. And so I totally understand what that's like when you have like a high stakes situation and you're in a room of hundreds, if not thousands of people who don't grasp that that's the situation and you need to
somehow
communicate that to them. Right.
How would they know?
Right.
Right. Like, you know, don't misbehave, right? You know, like don't heckle,
right.
You know, don't have loud side conversations. That's like stuff that can be communicated easily, stuff that is like relative common sense if you go to see almost any kind of live performance, right? But like, it is a little harder to put a point on like, I know that you're enthusiastic and that you're just kind of like reacting. It feels like you're talking or I'm talking, you have something to add.
Right.
It's like not appropriate in a regular situation or right. A less high stakes, not recorded situation. It is like not desirable that someone would shout out a punchline, but it's also like something you can roll with and just kind of be like, hey, that good one.
Yeah.
Or like,
yeah.
Hey,
nice try, you know,
nice try. Exactly. But because I had to be like a little firmer, because it was a recording, and I originally had reservations about putting it on the record because I don't like the idea of like showing someone not even heckling, but like having those kind of unsolicited audience responses, because like every heckler is like, I was helping. And so I don't like to promote that false theory, right? Like that like, oh yeah, you made the show better by chiming in drunkenly.
Right.
But Dominic Delveni, who I was working with on the record and who I trust, wasn't at the show, but like loved hearing the moment on the record and thought it felt very like spontaneous and live and made it feel like more intimate to the listener, which I do agree with, right? The listener at home is like, oh, it's like I was in the room for this show, not just like I'm hearing a concert being reproduced for me. So I ended up leaving it in, but I was like very on the fence.
Right, right. And it sounds like a challenge, you know, to have this nicer persona, because this whole thing about like how mean can you be to someone is a thing you then have to navigate. Whereas if your persona was you're an asshole, like you wouldn't even need to think about that, right?
Sure. I think it's a different kind of challenge though. Like, because like Gary said, you do get a lot of because you're doing something that is slightly unexpected, you buy yourself something, right? Like you're automatically doing something that is a little unexpected. Mm. And so there's that benefit of like, you're not starting from a place that people expect. So there's like a little charge that you get, like in the same way that you can get a charge from like telling an audience, like this thing you love, I think it sucks. You can get the same charge, right? From being like this thing that you think sucks, I think is cool. And it gives you the same, like, there's a tension. That's what it is. There's like a dramatic tension to the comedy at that point, because they like disagree in a not aggressive way, but like they disagree. So there's that tension of like, I want to hear what comes next, which is very useful to getting them to like reeling in an audience. So you do get a lot from it. And I think you lose a little bit, but you lose a little bit and gain a little bit, to, like, no matter what your persona is, right? Like if you're someone who comes up on stage and is like very negative, you are at the risk of maybe like alienating older people or alienating younger people even, right? Like that have a more, a different sensibility, that they're not coming to hear like, screw that. Like no matter how you calibrate your comedy, if there's an element of like, how do I reach the people that do not naturally relate to this point of view?
Speaking of reaching people who you might not easily relate with, in your book, you talk about working at a preschool for a few years before you became a writer.
Yeah.
And you talk about how, you know, it was nice to have like steady income while you're pursuing artistic things. And I'm curious about if there's anything you learned from that job that helped you with your eventual career.
Oh, great question. I definitely learned a lot from that job. And I think what you said about reaching people that, like, communicating to people that aren't necessarily ready for what you have to hear or interested or have a frame of reference for what you have to hear is a really useful skill in comedy and in preschool teaching. I say, I have a bit on the newest album where I say, like, I learned about meeting people on their level, like finding a way to bring people to you and not necessarily coming to them, right? Because like, if you just go to where a preschooler wants to communicate, you're showing Peppa Pig cartoons exclusively, or just letting them eat candy all the time. But like a way to bring like a gang of children who are like a pirate crew of children ready to mutiny at any time, to bring them to like, hey, I'm going to teach you this thing that might feel a little foreign to you or a little uncomfortable to you. The words to a new song that might be hard to remember at first, or the rules to a game that you've never played before, or an arts and crafts technique, and to like meet them in a way that like they grow to where you are, but you are acknowledging like you aren't ready to hear it exactly the way I would say it if I were just communicating. If I were teaching me this, I would say it in a different way.
Yeah, I mean,
and it's the same with audiences, right? Like if I'm trying to get an idea across to people that I'm in a city I've never been, I'm talking to an audience of people from like various demographics, whether it's like age, income level, place they grew up, just like cultural touchstones, race. The way to like extend that generosity of like, hey, maybe this is the way that I know to tell anyone this, rather than people who have like my exact frame of reference.
One of the things that I was really struck by, moved by, you know, is this idea that you need to have like a lot of patience in that job, right? You need to be willing to absorb all kinds of tantrums and other things in order to survive.
For sure.
And it seemed like you felt like you were well suited to do this, right? Like that yeah. you felt like you had a personality for that.
I absolutely do. I think I had especially like, I mean, I said to the teachers I used to work with, I had like a lot of patience for tantrums. I had way less patience for kids that were like acting out aggressively toward, because that would like, I would just be like, you can't hit them. That's the rule. Like, and my other teachers would be like, are you frustrated? I worked with mostly women and they would have almost exclusively, and they had a lot more patience generally for that kind of like a little boy who just like was impulsive and aggressive. And they would, I really admired the way they'd be like, there must be something underneath this that is making you feel this way. But I was like the cooler when there were tantrums, when a little boy or often a little girl would just like unleash this emotional meltdown. I had a lot of patience because it wasn't about me, and it doesn't help to fight it. It's like quicksand, right? Like when a kid is crying, you can't react in an equal opposite measure of like, stop crying, knock it off. Like that doesn't work. And you just kind of have to like give yourself over to this wave of feeling and then try to guide them out of it and hear them, but also like, hey, what can we do about this? As opposed to like, we don't have time.
Right. Did it change how you view adults and their emotions? Because I know some people, when they go through an experience like that, they have less or more patience with adults. Like some people like, well, I get that if you're a kid, you do X. But if now that you're 30 years older, you know, you need to have learned better. Did it affect how you have patience for adults and their emotions?
I think it did. I think like just dealing with feelings at that kind of visceral level is like, it's good practice for adults too. And I said it in the book, like when it kind of, both things kind of informed each other. Like I wrote in the book, like when you're a straight man in your 20s, like you have experience with people crying at you because like you're not good enough at being a person to avoid that happening.
Yeah.
Like people are going to cry. And you have to like, that's part of living. And I think I have a lot of patience for it. And some of it probably was informed by that preschool time of like, it's a lesson you're told as just a person of like, don't always try to solve people's problems, like hear their problems and be present for them and validate those feelings. But that's that working with kids really helped me take that lesson to heart because as an adult, I think even when you're very upset, when someone's trying to like solve your problem, you kind of feel like you have to acknowledge their attempts and like reason with those attempts. But when you're a kid, if someone's just like, well, use that crayon, like kids don't give a shit how rational you are. And no one's yet told them that they have to pretend to give a shit.
Right. So Josh, I want to ask you about later on in your career, after you worked at the preschool, you obviously were a writer for John Oliver's Last Week Tonight, which is a wildly popular show. It's well known for extremely well-researched pieces that assess some component of American life, which can often seem to be uninteresting, but the show makes it interesting. I can't let you go without one Last Week Tonight question before I get back to the book, which is like, to the extent that you can share, how those pieces come together. And specifically, like, I'm wondering how you make them funny. You know, like, do you start with like, okay, this is a point we're trying to make about this specific topic, and then like, we'll just sprinkle in some jokes? Or do the jokes happen as like the research is occurring? Like, tell us about like how one of those segments gets built, because these segments are viral and they're viewed by millions of people.
Great question. The way that the pieces come together, it's a long process. It's several weeks involving John and then Tim Carvel, who's an executive producer there, and then a producer who works mostly, a segment producer or a producer who works with footage, a producer who works with research, and then probably like a AP, an assistant producer or associate producer from the research department. So it's like a big team that works on them. And the comedy kind of comes at different times, depending on what's needed. Like sometimes, and so because it doesn't start usually with here's a point we're trying to make about this topic. It usually starts with like, is this topic enough to talk about on TV? Like, is there enough here that is interesting and new to people that it's worth talking about for this at this length? And then it becomes like, okay, once we think it is, like, what is the point of it, right? Like, that's like kind of step two is like, what do we want to say about it? And so the comedy comes in all different places. Like, you can start with like, oh, this piece of footage that we have is like going to be a cornerstone of the piece. Like, we're going to come back to it. It's really funny on its face. There's funny stuff to comment about it. That injects some life and fun into it. Then there's the level of like, oh, we saw this thing that's really, really kind of memorable, a memorable piece of footage, a memorable fact. We can build out an ending to the piece that is a funny version of that, right? Like a comedic parallel to that. So that can, that could happen early on if we know, or we knew early on in the process, like, oh, this is where we're going to want to land. We feel pretty confident about that. Or it could happen just a couple days before the piece airs, when you go, oh, okay, like, I think we feel strongly enough at this point that this is how we want to end. This is like the takeaway we want to give people. And then the jokes come through drafts, and then the weekend that the show is about to air, usually some on Friday, all of Saturday, and then Sunday morning is the writers like adding replacement jokes, adding jokes where there haven't been jokes. You just like pitching a zillion jokes. So like the comedy happens kind of at all different phases, depending on what the source material is, what the topic at hand is, and like how much ballast you need to like keep the story afloat.
Fascinating. So it sounds like for the main narrative, it's like, it's iterative, and there is some comedic elements that you factor in. But then, like, there's like a few more passes right at the end where it's just like, let's like make this as funny as possible.
Yeah, let's make it as funny as it can be. Like, we know where we need the jokes. Some of the jokes will have been from like first drafts, and then it's the kind of like cementing that comedy and cementing the language to make sure everything is clearly communicated and that the jokes are as strong. Like that John and Tim have seen as many options as it takes to make them go like, that's exactly the right joke for this situation. Is really helpful. I mean, they're like such rigorous and principled like joke writers and comedy writers. And it's cool it was like really amazing to have worked under them for so long. And kind of like a takeaway from my time there is just like, you can rewrite this joke until you get it just right. Like, you don't, especially if you have a week to make 30 minutes of television, you'd better get it right. Like, you can't go to air with something sloppy that you've had, that you've really been working on for 4 weeks, but you know, you've had the week to get it seaworthy.
Right. Like they impressed upon you the need for excellence when it comes.
Yeah.
To
or like the needs of like, even like everything kind of serving its purpose to the maximum, like a joke that like does kind of the lifting of hammering home a point that you're making, or a joke that like really punctures the tension or relieves the gloom of a certain thing, and just like making sure that you're really mindful of like writing the jokes that do the kind of work that you're trying to get done, as opposed to just like any joke that might work. And so that was like a really wonderful education that I got from working with them for so long.
One of the things I sensed in the book while reading it, particularly towards the end, is that you're kind of grappling with how to be a good person in today's polarized political environment, right?
Yeah.
And that's something that you are obviously very, like, you know, the book's called Nice Try. You're a nice guy. You're very much kind of trying to be considerate is what I sense, right? And that this is a legitimate challenge these days, right? And I'm curious, like, From my perspective, the last week, Tonight with John Oliver show, you know, I don't want to overstate its impact on American life, but I don't want to understate it either. Like, I feel like it has done a decent job of bringing people's attention to important issues, and on some cases, actually driving change for those issues. And I'm curious, like, how you think of your role in that. Do you feel like, Because it doesn't come across in the book that you're like, oh, well, look at all these things I've done through this John Oliver show and my other works. You know, like, that's not the sense I get from you, that you're very self-satisfied with that. And so I'm curious, like, what you think of that show's role and or your work's role in, like, bettering the lives of others.
So that's, again, man, you're really knocking these out of the park. There's so much to this one, of course. But that's, I mean, something that I think about a lot. I want to make work that reflects my ideas and values. And that's how I felt what I was trying to do as a part of the staff on Last Week Tonight as well. And it wasn't necessarily that, like, the idea was to move the needle on issues. The idea was to, like, create a comedy show that puts ideas into the world that, like, reflect the values of the, I mean, ultimately it was John, right? Because he had to go on TV and say it, but, like, what everyone, I think all the writers felt like we wanted to say the things that we believe. And so it was a lot of different voices, that was all kind of filtered through John's perspective. So the book is, I really do grapple with the idea of, like, it is very natural and easy for me to be a nice person. And that doesn't always mean being a good person, right? Like, there are times where being nice is the wrong thing to do. And there's times where, like, being kind of a dick is the right thing to do. And, it's sometimes hard to parse, like, exactly how to calibrate your attitude in any given situation of, like, oh, I should extend more empathy to this person that I hadn't considered their experience or their journey here, or I should be harder on this person who seems benign because what they're doing is, like, secretly kind of sinister. So, like, that's something I think about a lot, is that, and that's, like, kind of the arc of the book to me, is, like, trying to grow into a person who knows how to do that and knows when to do that. And so the work itself, I'm trying to reflect that, and I'm trying to, like, extend that generosity to people who not deserve that. That makes me sound like a sociopath, like, who deserves goodness, but, like,
you decide.
Yeah. Right. I'm the decider. But, like, extend that generosity where that's due and extend that empathy where that's due, but then also to, like, not let people off the hook for bullshit. And that's like an ongoing project for me.
Well, speaking of extending empathy, one of my favorite features of Twitter is your Twitter pep talks.
Thank you.
And let's talk a little bit about them. Like, I read the origin story of the Twitter pep talks in the book, and I'm wondering if you'd feel comfortable sharing that with our listeners.
Sure. So I was in a kind of a funk career-wise. I had a couple of things that I thought were going to happen that I was really excited for that didn't pan out. And I was feeling a little low. This was kind of just before I got hired at Last Week Tonight. It was, like, a couple months before. And the kind of final straw, like, I'd sold a piece of writing that didn't end up running. It got killed at the last minute and ended up running somewhere else. But, like, it was kind of a blow when it got squashed. And I thought I was going to do a late night set on a late night show, and that it got bumped because of content reasons. And then the show got canceled. And so that just, that evaporated. Yeah. And so just these things that were, like, little career setbacks and disappointments. And it had come, this was almost a year after the Modern Seinfeld thing popped, and I was starting to get these opportunities, and I was at I was starting to think of myself as, like, maybe I'm the guy who blows opportunities, right? Like, maybe I'm not quite good enough to step up to the plate when I'm asked to. And so I was feeling in a kind of low place. And then two things happened. Number one is I saw the movie Inside Llewyn Davis starring Oscar Isaac. And I was like, that's me. I'm that guy. I'm, like, the dickhead who is fully convinced that he's destined for bigger things. I think the key part about Inside Llewyn Davis is that Llewyn Davis is, like, a pretty talented folk musician. Like, he's not bad, but he destroys his life and the lives of people around him because he is insistent of his own greatness and his own entitlement, right? And I was like, yeah, that's me.
We should also point out that, in, you know, minor spoiler for Inside Llewyn Davis, but, like, he never really achieves what he wants to.
Correct. Right? Yeah.
He's kind of destined for failure.
Yes. And that, I think, like, that is like the feature to me of his, of that character, is that it's the futility, the futility of both, like, the limits of his own capacity that he refuses to acknowledge, and selfish single-mindedness with, right, which he pursues more than he deserves.
It's a deadly combination.
Yeah, it's really
those
gross.
Two things.
It's like,
yeah,
a deeply gross character, wonderfully conceived and written, but like, just, I related to all the worst parts because I was in a bad place mentally myself. And so, excuse me, I saw that movie and I'm kind of thinking, I think this is the right chronology. Maybe the movie came after the pep talk started, but like, it feels like it was all the same day, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So I was like, yeah, I'm that jerk. And then I was supposed to do this little, you know, all this stuff was kind of falling away. Just these little things that I thought were going to be little steps forward that ended up being, staying in exactly the same place, but plus disappointment. So, I had this gig that I was going to headline in Connecticut, and you know, it would have been a couple hours up, a couple hours back, hour and a half up, hour and a half back, whatever. And I was like excited for it. It just felt like, oh, I don't do a lot of headlining, but I'm trying to break in. So any room that I can do, I'm so glad for the opportunity and the practice. So the day of the gig, the person who had booked me told me, like, oh yeah, the front door of this venue is padlocked shut. I think they like got closed in the night for some reason. And so we have to cancel the show. Like, there aren't enough tickets sold to make it worth like moving or to another venue at last minute. Like, so it's canceled. And
so you'd already been going through some career problems.
Yeah.
And then you were like, well, at least I got this gig. I get,
yeah,
to do tonight.
Like,
and then the gig went
up
through. Yeah.
Yes. It was like, I know I can do stand up. That's like a thing that I've been doing. I'm not trying to like reach beyond myself. This is something I've done before, something I can do again. And then so when that gig canceled, I was like in a very personally needy place. And I was like, you know, I have this little social media following. It was like several thousand people on Twitter, not that many. And I was like,
now it is quite substantial.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. It's bigger now,
yeah.
But it's still like, it's like a nice following to have, for like a person who is not a famous person. And I'm very grateful for it. So in this night, I was like, you know, whatever it was, 5,000 people 6 years ago, 10,000 people. I kind of had this thought of like, maybe I could ask someone to say a nice thing to me. That's what, right, I really hear. Like, truly, that was where I was like that low of like, maybe a stranger will tell me something nice. Maybe I can just ask for that. But what I realized was like, I didn't need to ask 5,000 people to say something nice. Like, that was just more input than I needed to receive and navigate. But I thought like, if I ask other people if they need something nice, I can tell them, I can encourage them and let them know that like things are maybe not as bad as they think. Or if they are, if they're equally as bad as they feel, they can be better or different in time. And I felt like if I could encourage someone else, maybe I would internalize it myself. Maybe like, because maybe I could see that like, I'm not destined for failure just because I'm like not experiencing success right now. And because that was like all I really needed to like internalize at that moment was like, you're not the guy who fails forever. That's like a narrative you've created for yourself. And so I did that and it resonated with people and it felt good for me. And now it's something I do like pretty frequently. I do it a lot of the time when I'm on the road. It's like I do it very reliably when I'm on the road because it's like a nice way to unwind after a show when there's like, I'm not a big like go out and party after shows guy. And so you get off stage and you kind of have that charge and you've just been talking with people for an hour or whatever. And it's like a nice kind of, step down from like human contact before sleep. So it's like, and people are very appreciative of it, I think. And, you know, maybe there are people that it rubs the wrong way, but I don't hear from them often. And I think most of the time people treat it for what it is. It's just like, it is nice to have someone with whom you have like no baggage, right? Like there's no baggage attached to my relationship to a lot of the people that reach out, and to just be like, hey, as an outside observer, I think it can be all right. And right. And that's like a nice little thing. It's not much. It's not therapy. It's not medication. It's not like financial support, but I think it feels nice. And I know it because I've been on the other side of it. When someone goes, hey, this thing you do, like you're doing a good job. You're doing better than you're afraid you're doing. And it doesn't always have to feel this bad. It's just like a nice little thing to hear.
Yeah. And we should be clear, like, let's say people want to receive a Twitter pep talk from you. Yeah. What's the best way to do that?
So the secret is I will cave to basically any request at any time.
Oh, snap. Okay.
I'm a pushover. But the other part of it is I will do it. Usually I'll say like, hey, I have, I'll tweet late in the evening. I'll say like, hey, if anybody needs to hear a kind word or a pep talk, I'm here for 5 minutes, 7 minutes. Just let me know. Just reply here. And excuse me, I did it last night and I probably got like, I think 80 or so people, which is like, you know, and it doesn't take that much. It's not, I try to be as personal as I can and specific as I can. Sometimes people go, I have a job interview tomorrow and I'm really nervous about it. And that gives you something to work with. So you're not just like, you're doing great, kid.
Right. At this point, you've given hundreds of these Twitter pep talks.
Yeah, probably thousands.
Yeah, it's thousands. And you kind of shared some of your learnings in the book. You know, are there any trends or any insights you have about human nature from giving thousands of Twitter pep talks?
I think there are a few things of this current moment that come up. I mean, there's a lot of people just say, like, I'm really despairing in this current political climate. And that's very understandable. And, you know, not like the world was perfect before the election of Donald Trump, but I think there's an added layer of intentional and explicit cruelty that just feels like it's percolating that's not just the state enacting this cruelty, that it's like almost encouraging of that cruelty in private citizens too, if that makes sense. It feels, and maybe that's just like my privilege of not having felt it as acutely before. But I think there's a lot of people that are just like, it feels really bad now. And I think that's really valid. And you can't say that it doesn't or shouldn't feel like that. To me, the number one thing that I tried to tell people and that I try to remember myself is like, there are people working so hard to make things better. The people who are, I mean, the Jews Against ICE protesting the detention sites, right? Like that to me is like, there's a bravery to it and a leveraging of one's own privilege for the benefit of people who are marginalized and who are immediately impacted by this. And that's like something that like, okay, I aspire to giving that much of myself, and seeing that is like, okay, that's to me like a gold standard of activism, of like hearing what people need and joining with them in solidarity. And then like, how can I get as close to that in my life as possible? And that's what I say to people. I say like, look, there are people, and it's like a version of that I think it's a real quote. I don't think it's apocryphal. The Mr. Rogers, like, look for the helpers. But like the next step from that is like, how do you make yourself as helpful as possible? And like, you can do it. You don't have to sit and like hope for someone to fix things or fear that no one will fix things. You can like be a part of the solution.
There's just two observations I want to point out about that chapter of your book, which I mm-hmm. really appreciated. One is that I really like the way you put it, that you said you thought you were at a ceiling of your career, but you're really about to break through a wall, you know?
Yeah.
You thought it was a ceiling. In fact, it was a wall. You know, architecturally, you're a little confused about your career, but
that's it.
But I think it's interesting because really, the narrative that you tell yourself about where your career is, it's so important to shaping your self-worth a lot of the time. And often we just don't have the information we need to make that assessment in a clear-headed way.
Either you don't have an outside perspective on your own life, or you don't have the next point on this.
Exactly. The next point
of this data plot, because you can't have it yet.
Yeah.
And it's hard to trust that it will reverse a trend, or that like what you're seeing now isn't a trend. It's like an aberration, or that there are no trends. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like you are experiencing something that's painful, but that doesn't mean like this is what you're set up for forever. It's like right now. And it's hard to take that like geological long-term view of your own life.
Yeah. When you're a long enough timeline, you know, dot, dot, dot.
Yes.
But the other thing I really appreciated about it, Josh, was this sentiment that you said, you know, I needed to hear kind words of encouragement, even if they were coming out of my mouth. You know, like that you're in a bad place and that you need to hear kind words of encouragement, but that it doesn't even necessarily matter where it comes from, even if it's from you. And that like the idea of just putting positivity into the world is able to kind of redound back to you in a way that makes you feel better. I really appreciated reading about that. That's I hadn't thought of it that way before, you know? And go ahead.
I have like a real like anxiety and drive to be like useful and helpful, so that it like really feeds into that, to be like, if I am creating that kind of space, then it is possible, and I feel like at least I'm accomplishing something and capable of something and bringing that kind of like goodness that I wanted to see.
Well, Josh Gondelman, you are a comedian and writer who has won 2 Peabody Awards, 3 Emmys, and 2 WGA Awards for your work on Last Week Tonight with John Oliver on HBO. Josh Gondelman is also a writer and producer for Desus and Miro. His new book, Nice Try, Stories of Best Intentions and Mixed Results, is available now wherever books are sold. Josh, thanks so much for joining me today. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. What a nice time. I appreciate your taking the time.
That's going to do it for us today on Culturally Relevant. No weekly recommendations this week because I've been away, but I will return with more weekly recommendations next week. You can find more episodes of this podcast at culturallyrelevantshow.com. Email us at culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com and find us on Twitter at CrevShow. That's CrevShow. This podcast was produced by me, David Chen, and edited by me and Sean Michael Fox at fspodcasts.com. It's also powered by Simplecast. If you are looking to start your own podcast, check out simplecast.com. They offer some great features for getting started. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.